I was going to base this talk on my PhD research, which the title of my thesis is Men, Masculinities and Fatherhood in Global Finance, the Study of Hegemonic Practices in London. So the research examines the finance sector in London as a locus for two hegemonic processes, masculinity and spatial arrangements, which contribute to the gender dominance of the finance industry. The thesis explores how the finance sector interrelates with the global city of London and considers how structures and practices of global finance and the work and family lives of men employed in management and banking in London support, confirm or contest hegemony. So the PhD has two primary research questions. How do spatial arrangements of the city, particularly banks and their location, and the spatial arrangements relating to the families of people who work in the finance sector, support hegemonic masculinity in global finance and the local and global hegemony of the finance sector? And the second question, how do the social practices relating to the work, home and family lives of men working in the finance industry confirm the hegemonic masculinity in global finance and the local and global hegemony of the finance sector? So the rationale behind the research includes the increasing levels of forms of gendered inequality in London and globally, particularly the ever-widening gap between high and low-income workers, the ongoing dominance of men in positions of power in the finance industry, and the apparent privileging of certain men and particular forms of masculinity, the continued dominance and power of financial institutions in spite of the 2008 financial crisis, and the ongoing effects of this crisis on people and societies around the world, and findings from my previous research and other research of high-status corporate management, which suggests ongoing differences for men and women in the way in which parenthood is perceived in the corporate workplace in spite of increasing gender equality measures. So men are seen to be able to combine work and family easily, whereas women are still not, motherhood is still seen as problematic. But also related to this, the potential for changing ideals of fatherhood towards a more hands-on caregiving approach to fatherhood to be a potential crisis tendency for corporate hegemonic masculinity. So in terms of the study's theoretical approach, I draw particularly on Gramsci's concept of hegemony to explore hegemony as a continual process which attends to the ways in which the ruling class establishes and maintains its domination. So hegemony is a process which has at its heart the successful claim to authority that is taken for granted. And so in using the concept of hegemonic masculinity, the study explores ways the social relations and everyday social practices of elite finance workers help shape and confirm hegemonic masculinity in global finance. The PhD uses qualitative research methods and comprises seven case studies of men between the ages of 28 and 50 who are fathers and who work in management in banking in the city. I conducted in-depth interviews with the men and their partners. They are all married, actually, which wasn't an essential part of the criteria, but they are all married. And I also kept detailed field notes and conducted some observations in the city. As part of the analysis, I also draw on promotional material from the corporate websites of eight major banks located in the city in order to explore how notions of hegemony are constituted and conferred through official discourse. So it's a small study, a small in-depth study, designed to give an insight into issues rather than offer any kind of definitive overview. So all the men were chosen on the basis that they shared the following characteristics. They work in management positions in banking in the city. So this is in order to ensure they're part of the elite financial class and thus, through the status and power associated with their jobs, have the ability or the potential ability to assert a level of social, cultural, economic and political authority and influence. The men also needed to be willing to be interviewed face-to-face, and their wives or partners also needed to be willing to be interviewed face-to-face. I wanted them all to be in a cohabiting relationship with the mother of their children so I could explore family relationships and practices more easily. And this was also important, bearing in mind how feminist studies of the family reveal how parenthood signifies a moment of change for couples and may invoke new relationships and forms of intimacy that could challenge patriarchal family structures. and hence the process of hegemonic masculinity. The men also needed to be educated in the UK in order to limit social and cultural variables that may shape different forms of social practice and affect the men's understandings of and engagement with different forms of hegemony, so norms relating to work or family structures, ideas about fatherhood and so on. All the men also, I also wanted them to have children of school age or younger so that issues to do with childcare and education are still current. But I wanted to interview men of different ages to explore how social practices relating to the hegemonies of global finance may be comparative or contrasting across different life and career stages. And I also wanted some men who'd been educated in the private sector and some men who'd been educated in the public, the state sector, so I could explore ways in which schooling as a social practice interrelates with other social practices relating to processes of hegemony. So it's quite difficult to sum up a whole thesis in under 20 minutes. But I thought I'd share a few examples from the data to illustrate both the socio-spatial and gendered aspects of the processes of hegemony. So I thought I'd first look at some quotes from Banks' promotional material and talk about the space of the city and the way Banks are based in the city. So first, Banks demonstrate institutional and employee power and claims to authority by drawing on their geographic positioning and their global capabilities. So, for example, Banks position themselves as global entities and use language such as visionary, pioneering, breaking new ground, leadership, leverage, which on the one hand illustrates and feeds back into the dominant status of leading banks in the finance and business world, and on the other hand paints a picture of the way they do or suggest they do business. So it helps masculinize the figurative space of elite banking and frames and defines the environment in which the men in the study work. It also frames the way the banks talk about their employees. So, for example, here are three extracts from the promotional material of three different leading banks, which illustrate how the language of the global is used to construct a multi-layered identity of institutional, individual and collective worth. So, first one from Goldman Sachs. Although our activities are measured in billions of dollars, we select our people one by one. For us to be successful, our men and women must reflect the diversity of the communities and cultures in which we operate. We know that the world of finance will not stand still and that complacency can lead to extinction. And the second quote from Morgan Stanley, global leadership rests on the talent of our people. To maintain our leadership, we need the broadest possible knowledge of the global markets in which we operate. That means our workforce must include the most skilled and creative individuals who represent a broad cross-section of our global community. And the third one from Deutsche Bank. Confident, decisive, motivated, looking for a fresh challenge, want to make the most of your talents, ready to join a bank where you can realise your true potential. We are a truly global, diverse and client-focused organisation which utilises local expertise and experience when required. So banks portray themselves as progressive, innovative, dynamic, glamorous, but they also depict themselves as benevolent, working to benefit the world with their better ideas and balanced decisions, and an all-embracing, representative and individually selected workforce. This is important in terms of banks' spatial claims to authority, but also because it legitimises current unequal structures of recruitment and reward. Because the ways in which banks position their elite workforce in a global dynamic and diverse space is not seen as problematic, the patriarchal nature of elite finance is legitimised. This image of banking centres on apparent notions of diversity, but in practice effectively blanks out most features of this diversity and masks discriminatory gendered practices in the workplace based on forms of difference. So the people who succeed in getting a job in the industry are, from the outset, presented as worthy, exceptional human beings. People worthy of joining what appears to be the most elite workforce on earth, which ignores forms of privilege such as family and class backgrounds and education backgrounds that will already at point of entry to banking have defined who is or is not able to enter the profession. The men also draw on and confirm this official institutional global discourse and describe banking as a global industry with global operations, etc. But also of note in the men's narratives is the emphasis they place on the centrality of London and the city as they reflect on the financial crisis, and whether banks or bankers will relocate elsewhere if regulations and so forth change the industry. So the first quote's from James. London is significant because of the time zone and because the states, they all speak English, so the next natural hub is London. But, you know, JP Morgan has their op guys in Bournemouth, cheaper rent, cheaper labour. People down there think they're getting a great job because it's paid more than other people. But compared with London, it's a lot less. I do think certain jobs, you've got to be in London to actually do it, and you've got to meet clients face to face. And the second quote from Adam. In the 90s, London became the kind of boom place. EU regulators are going to be pretty tough on banks, but, you know, banks are not going to move to Switzerland or France or anywhere else. You're still going to need a financial hub in Europe, and it's still going to be the city. The good thing about London is it's very easy to attract people to come and live here. The lifestyle's pretty good. It's a major city. People can come and get their kids into good schools, buy nice houses, and do all the cultural stuff and all the stuff they want to do. So London's positioning as a leading global financial centre is reinforced in these extracts. But what is particularly illuminating is, in terms of understanding how the process of hegemony works, is that its particular cultural features of the social relations of London, language, facilities, families, and so forth, good schools, that constitute aspects of this. So London's apparently natural and unshakable superior geographic locality not only feeds into and benefits from other forms of apparent cultural superiority, but helps constitute notions of individual worth and superiority on the part of employees, like Adam, who are discerning enough, it seems, to choose a city to work in. The same sense of self-worth and superiority based on spatial positioning is evident elsewhere. And in these next extracts, the men reflect on criticism of bankers' high salaries in the wake of the crisis. So the first one from Matt. People complain about what bankers get paid. I mean, bankers are well paid, let's face it, but the reality is, do you do a job that can be done by a Chinaman and expect to, over time, only get paid what the Chinaman gets paid? And the second one from Adam. Banking's no different to any other industry. They go to China, they go to Indonesia, and that's easy. India, and that's cheaper. That's the exact reason this bank has got some operations in a particular country, because it's cheaper. They don't have to pay someone to do the same job there as you do in London. They do fairly easy stuff. You don't have to be very highly trained to do it. They're not really very highly trained, and it shows. You know, you have to explain something to people there 500 times, whereas you only have to explain it once or twice to the guy in New York. So spatial hierarchy, distinguishing different places, as well as the people who work in them, is strengthened and normalised through associations with better education, training, innate ability, and is used to justify high salaries and bonuses paid to some people who work in global finance, and in turn the patriarchal structures of elite banking. So not only are high salaries and high bonuses apparently needed in a particular place, London or New York, to attract and retain the best people, but spatial positioning also justifies paying these high salaries. People in London are of better quality, and paying people elsewhere, Bournemouth, India, China, less money. In the PhD, I also look at ways in which other spatial aspects of banking in the city help reinforce these notions of worth and value and are fundamental to the processes of hegemony in global finance. So, for example, the amenities in the city space, including shops, but dry cleaners, and restaurants, bars, boutique hotels, and so on, which are important components of the hegemonic social fabric of the city space, because they provide opportunities for entertaining clients, networking, and so on, help knit the social and material world of global finance together. And the on-site amenities provided by banks, gyms, wellness centres, dentists, cafeterias, etc., which supposedly help with work-life balance, but which in effect help tie the workers to the workplace and facilitate the long hours culture, and again, patriarchal structures. So on-site and off-site facilities thus help reinforce the global standing of wealthy city banks. And because banks provide these services, their employees are able, as well as expected, to work hard, which supports the notion these workers are more committed than workers elsewhere, that they work longer, are better at their jobs, and so on. And this, in turn, helps contribute to the argument that city bankers deserve their higher than average wages. But it also crucially helps legitimate patriarchal structures in the workplace and the home. So working long hours inevitably requires someone else to undertake the majority of the day-to-day childcare responsibilities. So here the men skipping, and just to show different aspects of the process of hegemony. So here they talk again about their claims to academic, so intellectual sort of leadership. So here, when the men reflect on recruitment, so the first one by Adam, we take the top 0.5% of, well, we don't take all of them, but we choose from the top 0.5% of the university graduates, Oxford, Cambridge, Bristol, Edinburgh, Durham, those sorts of places. It's the same in New York, Harvard, Princeton, you know. And the second one from Matt, a lot of people we recruit, we know who we're looking for. There's a lot of perfect CVs, people with straight A's and great degrees. They went through the 20 criteria and ticked them all, but it's not that easy. It's not that easy. Yeah, I look for something exceptional. Essentially, a tiny proportion of people make a massive difference. So I look for someone who might have that unique quality, something which distinguishes them. I don't want a load of average people. So, so both these men position academic eliteness as the norm, which helps maintain the image and understanding of the financial workplace is rightfully powerful in the corporate world. And helps legitimise the high salaries and bonuses paid out to some employees. Adam positions himself as one of the elite of the already defined elite. Not everyone can attend the universities he refers to, and not everyone who does can then go on to be an investment banker. Matt implicitly associates academic eliteness with the ability to generate profit and success for the individual himself and the bank. References to gender are absent, which implies those who gain access are the very best ones selected from all capable applicants. It doesn't problematise the fact that men are in power in these powerful banks. And when you self-explanatory, so I'll go on to... So I thought I'd finish with some examples of the ways in which the men and women talk about the men's role as fathers, just to give also a contrast between the space of banking and the space of the family. So all of the women I interviewed either worked part-time or have left the paid workforce completely when they had children. That also wasn't a requirement of the choosing them, but that's what they have all done. both the men and women predominantly discuss this arrangement as the women's choice. But what is significant in terms of supporting the process of hegemony is first that the legitimisation of this gendered arrangement on the basis of the high salaries and bonuses that the men earn and the ways in which these high levels of material accumulation and the lifestyle choices they can buy are linked with notions of worth and well-being for the whole family. So that lends it a moral edge. So, for example, the men explain it as a kind of trade-off and draw heavily on neoliberal market-related language to talk about their family arrangements. The use of market language is significant because it suggests the current demands of the elite financial workplace, with patriarchal structures are fair and suitable not just for these men, but for all workers in similar jobs, and also for the men's wives and children. And here's some quotes from the women, the wives of those men, actually, which show how they support the current conditions of patriarchy in both the context of their family and in the context of the men's work. So the women all explain that it was their choice not to go to work, and explain how, well, for example, Kath, I realised that however much Dan was going to be involved as a dad, he was never going to compromise his work. Obviously, we're in a fortunate position, which is that Dan's salary pays enough, that actually my salary is irrelevant to our finances. The working is really for my mental satisfaction, so it has to be something that fits in. It's interesting that Kath is actually a teacher as well, but she still downplays completely the job that she's doing and the contribution she makes to the family. And so this is just the men talking about the other last thing I was going to say, really, is about the way that the men and the women position the men as optimum fathers. So even though they're frequently absent from the home, they do work long hours and they do travel a lot, and but they are generally not around during the week, so it's only at the weekends that they spend with their families. And it's not to suggest the men aren't good fathers and don't think deeply about the level and type of care they want to provide for their children, but it's quite significant that they still position themselves as superior parents. So here Matt suggests he thinks about things more than other people, Paul suggests he has a better parenting approach than other people, and Dan implies that he works harder than others to find the perfect balance between work and home. And these are interesting claims considering the gendered family structures and social practices men and their wives have organised and engage in, so that the men can fulfil their work and fatherhood roles. And none of the men really talk about the contribution their wives make. They talk about them facilitating the lives that their wives lead and their families lead. And it's also interesting that the women support this too. So, for example, Cara in the middle. Matt's constantly revising how we can make the most of our lives. He's always writing these little lists and things, and I think, gosh, you know, you're off doing this massive trip with basically 10 hours of meetings every day, you know, every day, and you have time to think of us. I think it's amazing. So the women are very supportive of the men's self-professed claims to superiority. So... that was just a snapshot, really, but some of the findings, I suppose. The main finding, really, is that rather than contesting hegemony, the data in the thesis suggests that new ideals of hands on caregiving fatherhood, and perhaps is related to them, are reconfigured by the men and the women in ways which confirm existing notions of hegemonic masculinity and spatial relations, spatial arrangements of global finance. So rather than compete with practices of breadwinning, present and engaged fathering, is facilitated by the women and conferred by them and their husbands in ways which reaffirm and strengthen the authority of their husbands at work and home. And it's particularly significant that it's the high salaries which are the fulcrum on which these processes of hegemony function. They provide justification for hard work, rewards for hard work, legitimisation for continuing notions of institutional and individual worthiness, and the seductive force of hegemony, including the patriarchal dividend. So the women do not support change necessarily. Well, this is probably the wrong way to say it, but because the women are also happy to benefit from their husband's high earnings and support the lifestyles that they and their children lead because of their husbands.